Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and our panel discussion for this Halloween, the 31st of October. Very nice to have you with us today. It's a very, very special day. I'll get to that in just a moment. But we're thankful you're here and we're going to have a very good morning. And we thank you for being a part of it. Let me introduce our panel to you and then we'll get started and do all the good stuff that we have to do this morning. Terry Gibson is here. He is a former New York State Senator and SUNY New Paltz Communications Professor and a regular on Wednesdays, and we're thrilled to have you here on this very special Wednesday. Good morning.
Thanks for having me. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. Jen Smith is here as well. She is a Berkshire Eagle reporter. She's very busy covering the elections, covering education, and it's almost over. You get a week, and then you get to, like, breathe.
No, you don't. Not as a reporter. You still have the aftermath of everything.
It never goes.
But it's good to be here.
And WAMC's Alan Shartok is in the house. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Boo.
Yeah, boo. Boo.
Yeah, we live in a place where, in Great Barrington, where they bus everybody in from all over the place to ask for candy. And last year, I think Roselle gave out 1,000 pieces of candy, 1,000 separate people when they come in. They will march up Hollenbeck Avenue. Police cars are there.
Give them the address, Alan. What the hell? And we are beyond thrilled to have Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist, an absolute idol, I think, to everyone in this room. Linda Ellerbe is with us this morning. Good morning, Linda.
Did I die?
No. I'll tell you, by the time
Those
this is over, it's going to sound
great.
Like... I put a piece together. You can hear it later, but we can use it as your obit as well.
It's always nice to have a multi-purpose.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I live in North Egremont, Alan, and no one ever finds our place.
That's because they're all at our place.
So I just want to set the tone here for a second, and then we'll get into the subjects of the day. But so, Linda, you retired in late 2015, December of 2015, and to my knowledge, so this will be like one of the first interviews that you've done where you don't have any affiliation with anybody.
That's right. I am a recovering journalist these days, which means that I can pretty much say anything I want within the bounds of not getting kicked off the air for certain words. And it's kind of an odd feeling after all these years. I mean, I don't believe in objectivity. There's no such thing as objectivity any more than there is a random number, but I have always believed in being fair as a reporter, and that is attainable. But now I don't even have to even try to be fair. I can just say what I think.
So let
without us, regard to it being right either.
Let us talk about, let's start here, and this is for the whole group, but I'll start with you, Linda, the profession that most of us are in here of journalism is under extreme attack by the President of the United States as we march toward the midterms in less than a week from yesterday. And not only the enemy of the people, but being blamed for heinous acts such as the shooting in Pittsburgh and the sending of pipe bombs to the president's political enemies. What do you make of this as a journalist and thinking of the role of a journalist in today's society?
I guess we have to, for that, go back to 2016. It was the first presidential campaign I had not covered since 1972. And, of course, it's always easy to look back at something when you're not in it. But I believe that many of us behaved badly. We fell into the trap of the equal time. Well, if they say, then they say. The idea of the journalism being he said, and then she said, you know, he says it's raining, she says it's sunny. And the reporter reports that instead of going over and opening the window and seeing whether it's raining or sunny and coming back and saying, that's wrong. I mean, for example, we have the word lie. Even now, why are journalists so loath to use the word lie when it comes to Donald Trump? Well, he misstated his facts, or he misspoke, or he did whatever. Yesterday, he said This is the only country in the world where you have birthright citizenship. That is what we call a lie. There are at least 30 other countries that have it. And yet, I heard it reported over and over yesterday without anybody bothering to say, that's a lie.
Mm.
So I don't think we've done a great job. I really don't. And it's just as well that I retired when I did, because I would have had to close Nick News. We were doing, you know, a news show for kids, and we covered elections.
It was terrific, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you. And we covered elections big time every 4 years. And I couldn't have done the false equivalency. So I would have had to say, I'm sorry, we're not going to do that. And Nickelodeon would have had to say, well, you know, we think we'll buy a news show from someone else. And then I would have had to close Lucky Duck Productions because I couldn't have done it. I really couldn't. I've wondered, could I do that? Did I do things like that? I'm sure I made worse mistakes. But that one, no. Now you see some journalists, and I'm over talking here, you've seen the Washington Post and the New York Times and some other very good papers trying to make amends.
Yeah.
And trying to do a much better job. But they cannot compete with this man and his Twitter account.
Alan, what do you make of it?
Well, no, I think Linda is right about everything she's just said. I have to say, in our own defense here, Linda, and I know you listen, I hope you listen.
I do.
We've been calling him a liar for a long time.
Yes, you have. You have.
And you know, right from the very beginning. And the press, it does make a lot of mistakes. I mean, today I just heard something on NPR, which I found really disgusting. They were saying... they reported dutifully that the Bureau of Prisons said that Whitey Bulger's demise was being investigated as a murder. What do you mean investigated as a murder? What do you mean investigated as a murder? The man was murdered. End of discussion.
Yes.
Well, you got to fill out. Yeah, you got to fill out the form, I guess.
I'm
right?
Glad they're not investigating it as a, you know, running a red light.
They even know how they did. You know, somebody put a lock in a sock and hit him over the head with it a million times. And that killed him.
Yeah, he's not hanging out with Elvis.
No.
So, Jen, I'll let you, before we move into our subjects for today, I'll let you take a whack at the Halloween pinata that is this question about journalism today.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of our coverage of Trump, we're perpetuating often the same thing that happened during the campaign season, which was to focus on him as a primary source for all issues that happen in the U.S. And I think we got to get over that, and we have to go to other places and remember that the issues are happening on the ground, not just in the Oval Office. And he doesn't know everything about everything. He's not our primary authority. And I think, you know, we have been demure about, you know, standing up for what is fact, and putting that in the nut graph instead of bearing the lead.
Well, anything you want to add to that, Terry?
Well, I would just say that I'd like to thank those of you in the media that are working so hard to actually bring out the truth, and I'm honored to be in the room with those that have done that. And I do just want to say that I am completely starstruck this morning. I am just so honored to be here with Linda Ellerbe. You know, I used to watch her when I was an undergraduate student, I think in my 20s, at Lubbock, Texas, early in the morning. All my friends were out at the bar, and I would come home to watch Linda Ellerbe.
Wow. And they made fun of me overnight.
They made fun of me about
drinking.
That. But, you know, but I do credit Linda with really bringing my attention to politics and news. And you had a lot to do with the decisions I made growing up and moving forward. So
Linda,
you
made the man everything he is today.
Should I apologize? I'm not certain.
You're a recovering journalist. He's a recovering politician.
Are reparations in order here?
Yes.
And if so, which way?
Yeah, well, we can work something out.
But Terry, I want to ask you, can I have
a fast question? Yeah.
And that is, you know, clearly as a politician, you had journalists who wrote stories you thought were either unfair or wrong.
Absolutely.
What was your recompense? I mean, how could you deal with that?
Well, you know, I think the most frustrating thing is that you say things in well thought out, complete sentences, complete paragraphs that you mean to be taken as a whole, and oftentimes journalists will grab one sentence.
Out of context. It was out of context, I tell you.
And turn into something that you never meant, and that is always very frustrating. But, you know, I guess for me, it was always looking at the other side, that the downside would be that they just wouldn't cover what I said at all, and that the opportunity to be able to get what they would cover out in front of the people was better than the alternative. So I've always appreciated free press, even though, you know, as a person working in the political field, it comes with some pain every now and then. But the alternative is that they don't cover what's being said, and that would be very damaging. So I think you just have to take it all in balance.
So let's dive into today's stories. We'll begin in Pittsburgh. One of Pittsburgh's most solemn days began with hundreds coming together in anguish and grief in synagogues and at gravesides to start the services for those killed as they prayed on the Sabbath. In the afternoon, they came together again in shivas to honor the dead and comfort the living, and later by the thousands in solemn marches of protest around the Squirrel Hill neighborhood where the attack took place on Saturday. This is the Pittsburgh that met President Trump, who arrived with members of his family on Tuesday. Reading from the New York Times, the presidential visit, welcomed by some in Pittsburgh, unwanted or vigorously opposed by many others, began with a motorcade into the city and visited the Tree of Life Synagogue. Mr. Trump lit memorial candles in a vestibule near where the shooting unfolded and placed stones and white roses from the White House outside in commemoration of those killed in an attack by a gunman full of anti-Semitic rage, shouting that Jews must die. But if Mr. Trump's visit was intended to bring healing and instead laid bare the nation's deep divisions, many protesters in Pittsburgh had no doubt of what one called the dotted line between presidential rhetoric and violence. Though some people in the city have pushed back on the idea that Trump had fermented the atmosphere of anger, as the president moved around Pittsburgh, a largely Democratic city, the signs of discord were apparent. Alan.
I'm going to get in trouble, as usual. I think I'm the only
Jewish. It's Wednesday.
I think I'm the only Jewish person in the room. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I can only speak for me. No, I'm not Jewish.
No, I think I'm the only Jewish person in the room. I tell you what really frustrated me, was the rabbi at the synagogue who welcomed the president, and he said, "He's my president." And therefore, he accompanied him as he went around. I was extraordinarily frustrated by that because I truly assign blame to this president for what has happened. I think he has proudly talked about the fact that he has to have enemies and that he does this kind of thing. And I think that the rage that has gone on to some of these paranoid people's heads is directly laid to him. He had Pence this morning out there saying he had nothing to do. It had nothing to do with Trump, but of course it had to do with Trump. It's ridiculous because I wish I could tell you that Trump isn't proud of the fact that he's divisive and he makes that kind of thing happen. And now to trot out a few Jewish relatives and say that this proves that I am not guilty of any of this is ridiculous, and shame on Pence. That's what I have to say.
Linda?
But Alan, there are very fine people on both sides.
Yeah, of course, there's your false equivalence.
Yeah. No, I agree with you completely, Alan. It was shameful. I hurt for it. I want to apologize. I'm not sure who I'm apologizing for, but I know who I'm apologizing to. I'm apologizing to people who have been wronged and had their justice robbed from them and have had hateful things said about them and are now having hateful things done to them. Mm-hmm. And there is no way to escape the connection from he said to they did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There isn't.
Jen?
I think one of the best things that I read the past couple of days has just been the coverage from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who just,
terrific.
I mean, God love those people.
Terrific.
And that's why local journalism is so important, because they're covering their own community. And what they did so well was, yes, they covered the visit, but they covered the funerals, the brothers, their front page, they have this wonderful interactive where you can, you know, wonderful in a terrible situation, but they put the focus where it matters, which is of these members of the community who were persecuted because of who they were. And they showed, yes, there's so much division, but they also showed the capability of being united. School children just coming together within 24 hours after this happening and doing what they could in front of their campus's Holocaust memorial to say that this was a hate crime. They put that, it was like the first statement that was said by, you know, a 13, 14-year-old. They know better, and the community knows better. And I think that's what we can't forget in this case. Absolutely, we have to watchdog the president's actions and what is said. I think the best thing he did yesterday was shut up for 4 hours and just hopefully listen to people in the time that he spent there. But, you know, there's a lot that this community will have to deal with. I've been covering, I grew up in the era of Columbine, been covering mass shootings for a long time now. And this is something that affects the community for a long time. There's a lot of questioning, a lot of policies that need to change. And there's a lot of stances. Yeah, you have to look at your own community and what hate crimes are happening there. What causes the way people act.
Got about a minute.
I just struggle with this idea that we live in a country where we somehow think that it's necessary for our elected officials to be there when some type of awful thing happens like this to our fellow citizens. But at the same time, while there's some logic to that, we elect people into public office first and foremost to be leaders, to address the issues in society that need to be resolved, to make us safer, to make us more educated, to make us healthier. And when those leaders are not doing those things that we elect them to do, and all they're doing is showing up at places that are the result of inaction on their parts, then I find that very disturbing. And I think that that's what he did yesterday by going to Pittsburgh, is that he went to a place that has suffered from inaction on both his part and others in terms of dealing with the gun crisis, in terms of dealing with the hostility in the world, and that bothers me.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll welcome letters as well. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Terry Gibson, and our special guest Linda Ellerbe on the roundtable panel this morning. We will return right after this.
Far is the spider.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, Alan Chartok, and Linda Ellerbe joining us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to letters, and then we'll move into other subjects as well.
It is not surprising that we are getting many, many Linda Ellerbe letters this morning, and how wonderful Linda is. Thank you, panel, for having the author of one of my favorite books on today. Well, Linda did overnight. I would record it and see if there's a story I could use as a light feature kicker to a morning newscast I did in Houston, Texas.
Stole from Linda Ellerbe? Okay, go ahead.
Got called a commie who quotes another commie. For so doing, which can only make a journalist proud in Texas. Thank Linda for coming to WAMC for me, and thank y'all. See, that's authentic now.
That's
thank
great.
Thank y'all for having her on.
And I'm right, we have two Texans in the room, right?
Yeah.
We have two Texans in the room. Okay.
We have Tyler, Texas, and we have College Station, Texas, right here in this room in Albany.
Yeah. By the way, my favorite of Linda's that I reuse with credit, of course, the one about the Easter pageant scuffle where Pontius Pilate ended up on the cross. And that's from Dr. Lisa in Oneonta. Okay. And good morning, panel, says Mary. Question two on the Massachusetts ballot is getting very little coverage, but it has the potential to have the broadest and longest-term effects on our democracy. Voting yes on question two would be a step towards reversing the 2010 Supreme Court decision to give corporations the right to take over our government with unlimited campaign spending.
It's the campaign spending bill.
And there you are. It's more, but
anything on that, Jen, you would like to add? Okay.
I absolutely
I'm
agree.
With you, Jen.
Yeah, the problem, of course, is not to be the bucket of bad cold water here is that it's the Supreme Court, you see. So even if the people vote something in to reverse it, which was a good step and which might make some progress in Massachusetts, it hardly dilutes the power of the Supreme Court and their corporate masters to do what they are doing. It's pretty simple. Bob says, if there's any debate about whether Trump actually opposes violent white supremacists as opposed to just giving lip service to national unity, his 80% cut in the 2017 to the federal funding for Obama combating violent extremism grants should end the discussion. Actions speak louder than words. And Peter says, let's face the sad truth. Our president cannot be president. He can only run for president. Well, anybody on that note?
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I would tend to agree.
Well, unfortunately,
but he is president.
I was like,
there's an office, and he has it. So.
There's even a job description.
Yeah. But I think he's just perpetually running and not actually doing the job. I think that's a pretty clear argument to make.
Well, you can make the argument, but I agree with the people who just yelled a little in the room here, Terry.
Yeah.
And that is that he is the president. And inaction, of course, is action in a way.
Right. Yeah,
you
know,
when
that's
you
true.
Think about it.
That's true.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, thank you for that good letter, Peter. And Tracy says, brilliant comment that journalists have a responsibility to go over to the window and see if it's raining or sunny. It feels like it's been more about ratings than reporting the truth. Brava, Linda. You know, I love to go to the opera in Great Barrington on the very, very rare occasions I've been there. And people are yelling, brava. See, brava.
Let's hope they're yelling it to female singers.
Were they yelling bravo to you, Alan? Were they giving you the bravo?
I'm just sitting there trying to understand what's going on. And Chase, because I think it's... Never mind.
Just go on.
Keep it going, Alan.
Oh, God, don't make me laugh. It only hurts. Jay says, thanks for Linda. Thanks for bringing Linda Ellerbe on the panel this morning. She made waking up too early as a kid tolerable when the network had Nick News reruns in the morning. Such a calm voice in digesting the news for the audience. I'm glad to hear that as a veteran journalist, she finds it as hard as I do to comprehend some of the lies and hypocrisy that often gets glossed over in the headlines, and that's Chasen Fleischman's New York. And Jamie says, cable news, even though it's far more intellectual and fact-based than cable news is today, I consider Miss Ellerbe to be the beginning of cable news. Her late-night reporting and occasional rants stood the news business on its ear. She established a model that has been copied by many but improved by none. And then he says, or she says, Jamie, thank you, ... I think.
That's an interesting thing, since NBC News Overnight was actually on NBC News and not cable, but it was put up. I mean, he's got it right. It was put on the air because CNN went on the air, and they were on the air 24 hours a day, and the broadcast networks looked at that and went, well, we haven't been putting anything on the air at that time.
Yeah.
What's the cheapest thing we can put on? Well, the cheapest thing we can put on is news. So all three broadcast networks went on with late night programming at the same time in 1980 and 1981, simply because of CNN. So cable was definitely the cause of it.
Mm. I keep remembering the wonderful Ed Morrow movie.
Good night and good luck.
Good night and good luck, in which they really did, CBS really did sell them out.
Yeah. Oh, they did. They did. But that's not new at networks.
No,
come on.
Of course not.
That's one of the things that is so fascinating about your career, because these shows were cheap. They would come on and they could do them cheaply, and yet they still didn't last.
No, they didn't. As far as overnight goes, I mean, we always felt that we were fortunate that we had the opportunity to do the show, because it aired late at night when most of our bosses were asleep, and that was because they were old, and that was a great opportunity, just that alone, and because we had no money. And the president of NBC said, we have no money for you to do this show. You're going to have to talk NBC correspondents into going and cutting a separate piece to air on your show at night. Now, these are correspondents that have already had to cut one for Nightly News and then recut another one for the Today Show the following morning. And there I'm going to come and ask them to do yet a third one for no money, no extra money. So the way we did it was I went around to all the bureaus and I said, if you will cut a piece for us, we will air it unless there's some glaring change in the story. We'll air it as you cut it. We will not do what Nightly News does and take your four-minute piece and reduce it to a minute 30. What you can do for us is the piece you really wanted to air on the evening news. Mm. And it worked. And they said, well, yeah, by gosh, somebody's going to let me actually report what I thought I should report.
One of the pieces that I remember so vividly from that show that I think falls into what you're just talking about was a piece that Andrea Mitchell did.
On the massage table.
Well, Andrea Mitchell did a story about President Reagan and the difference between of his of the press availabilities and a photo shoot as opposed to getting any news. And
oh yes, her photo shoot piece, it was wonderful.
Yeah,
it was just wonderful. You know, and we did things like that. We did things for fun that had truth in them, but were done for fun. One of the NBC editors noticed that Ronald Reagan, a former actor, had a habit of saluting everybody he saw, not just the Marine when he was getting off Marine One or the Air Force, but every time he saw someone, he saluted. He knew how to do it. He had been in a lot of Westerns and played a lot of cavalry officers.
You know, it's so great that you say that because some of his stories, and now maybe we can attribute some of it to the later terror of the Alzheimer's, were things that he said he did, but that he played an actor in a movie
yes.
doing. Yeah.
Yes. So we had this editor that went back and got his movies and then got all this footage from his presidency. And just, I wrote a lead in about noticing that the president enjoyed saluting and seemed to have some talent at it. And then we ran a piece of intercut of Reagan saluting and even a dog. Everything he saw. Now, I'm not sure if that said anything important, but it said something. And details are important.
I agree.
They certainly are.
You know, Linda, you said something that I find so interesting. When I get up early, early, early in the morning, the first thing I do is turn on the live news, and it's on the cable channel. And those two young people who are doing the news there in the morning, they always have people cut stories the night before, but use their names and say, you know, Dave and whatever, and so you get the idea. You're supposed to think, but nobody's that dumb, that they're there right at that moment, but they're not. They cut it the night before. Things could have happened, you know, overnight. And every once in a while, and you got to pray for this, one of them shows up late. One of the two anchors shows up late. So he says, thanks, Dave and Christine, whatever the name is. And
Christine is nowhere to be found.
And there's no Christine.
She's looking for David.
That's why I'm a print girl.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with, we have other stories to talk about. Want to get to birthright citizenship and a couple of other big stories. And we, of course, welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We got a couple, and we'll go to those, and then we'll move on and talk about other stories. Go, Alan.
Okay, so Alexander says, this morning around 5 a.m., I was getting coffee at my local Stewart's, and I couldn't help overhear the older men discussing Trump and commenting on how much they like that he's not a regular politician, specifically that he says what he's thinking. I couldn't bring myself to argue with them that early in the morning. However, it's distressing that people still support him, even after he's made it clear that he's willing to rip away citizenship from people who were born in the United States. I'm worried, and I'm happy that my family are gun owners. I hope to God it never comes to a situation like Germany in the 30s and 40s. And that's kind regards from Alexander. Interesting letter.
What happened to the gun part, but okay.
Well, that's why the framers wrote the guns into the Constitution,
right. Simply
because they thought if the government got too strong, the guns could be used against them. It hasn't exactly worked out that way.
No.
It's one of those. It's one of those truths that has made me crazy in 2016, and still makes me crazy. One of those quote alternative facts. I know what real facts are, and they actually add a lot to any story. But the thing, I mean, a fact: the government is not coming to take your guns. That is a fact. There is no invasion of immigrants. The First Amendment is there to protect your right to stand on the street corner and say the emperor is wearing no clothes, and to protect the right of people to go into synagogues or a church or a temple and worship in safety and in freedom. Those are facts. You know, there is no war against Christianity. There is no war against Christmas. Those are not facts. They are provable, not facts. And yet we keep being told these over and over and over. And they make me crazy. I mean, we look at gay people don't want to convert your children or you. That's not true. That is a lie. You know, black people are not taking a knee at games to show their unpatriotism. They are taking a knee to protest an injustice done to them systematically by this country over the years. And finally, I guess I have to say most of all, is this is not a scary time for boys. And it has always been a scary time for girls. Mm.
Paul says, Pence. Wow. The mention of Pence's ignorant comments about Trump's lack of connection to what happened in Pittsburgh reminds me of all the sycophants who, for whatever reason, follow along. History will judge their complicity nearly as harshly as it will judge the unspeakable behavior of the President of the United States. And that's from Paul in Albany. You know, it's so interesting, Linda, when you think about this, you know, Jack Kennedy and Profiles in Courage, and how few Profiles in Courage there are among politicians today, including among the Democrats. Sorry, Chuck, but it's just not there.
No. Mm. No, that's not there. You're right. I was trying to explain to a friend of mine in Houston on the telephone last night, who she doesn't particularly follow politics. It's her choice. We disagree on that, but never mind. And she said she couldn't understand. You know, Tom Cruise has done a perfectly fine job for this state. I can't imagine why we'd want. Not Tom Cruise.
Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz. Well, Tom may have
Tom's
done something
a little out
too,
there
but
too, but
I'll vote for Tom Cruise.
Ted Cruz.
I don't know.
I can't imagine
maybe
why.
Maybe equal on the crazy scale, but go ahead.
What this Beto is all about, what this thing is. And I said, well, Judy, you live in Texas, so perhaps you're not seeing this the way the rest of the country is seeing it. Because the rest of the country is looking at this young man and saying, if he can get by Cruz, then we may have a candidate
right
going forward. And she said, really? You mean people outside of Texas are paying attention to this race?
They're sending them a lot of money.
Me too. Yeah, I'm one of them.
Yeah.
Well, we could have an argument about what a lot constitutes. Well, but
let me ask you, as I'll ask the Texans in the room, but this race, I mean, one of the polls that came out yesterday shows him within 5 points. 3% margin of error and 6% undecided. That seems close to me, especially considering he was trailing by 9 points a month ago.
It's close, but, you know, it's going to be tough.
It's Texas.
Texas is red, red, very red, with deep, deep rooted redness in it. And so it's an exciting race. And I think the results of it either way are going to be good for the future, because I think it's brought a lot of people who were not normally engaged in politics. It's woken them up. And he's a great candidate. And I think he has a bright future ahead of him.
But, I do, too. But he has to get past Cruz.
Yes, he's got to.
Well, he does. But Cruz has not exactly, Linda, done a great job for himself.
Oh, he hasn't done a great job for anyone.
Well, I don't mean that. What I mean is as a candidate, you know, he hasn't shown the kind of get up and go that people would want to get behind.
Yeah.
And O'Rourke did. You know, I always have this feeling that there are times that even if you're on the other side, people like to throw a political, I want to emphasize what I'm saying here, hand grenade into the muck to just simply say, let's throw this in and see whether this can get politicians out of their stupor. Possible.
Yeah. But what do you think will get people to push that extra mile? What makes sense to Texans?
Well, but look how close it is.
Yeah, there's a question.
This race demonstrates very much the differences in Republicans and Democrats. You have to remember that running as a Democrat, you're all about trying to get the government to serve the people, to get the government to do things for the people. If you're running as a Republican, especially in Texas, you're all about not getting the government to do anything for the people. And
Until you need it.
So you say Ted hasn't done a great job of getting people to rise up and rally around him. Well, you know, I would just say that an awful lot of people in Texas like that because they don't want a politician trying to make government more functional.
And yet, Terry, why is it so close? Well, in other words, an awful lot of Texans have come over to the other side, and we know it's a red state, as you have correctly pointed out. I always thought there was something ironic in calling the Republicans reds, but that's another whole story.
Well, yes.
It's close because of evolution. Just nature is taking its course. It's a much more diverse state than it's ever been in every way possible, culturally, ethnically, and I think that's having a big difference in the results right now.
Certainly in places like Houston, which is next to L.A., the most diverse city in the United States. At the moment. Yeah. But you know, we go back to, and Joe and I talked about this earlier about polls. I've got to say, 2015, Thanksgiving, at our dinner table, there was discussion about Trump, and I said, and there's a lot of laughter, and I said, please don't, he's going to win. If he runs, he's going to win. And then everybody at the table went, nah, that's the joke. I said, no. It's true. I don't want to be Cassandra, but he's going to win. And they said, well, why do you think that? And I said, because we vote by secret ballot. And I will tell you that all my years as a reporter tell me that we are far more of a racist nation than we want to think we are or admit we are. And 72 years of being a woman tell me that this country is not real fond of a bossy woman, much less a woman boss. Mm-hmm. And so they're lying to the pollsters because they don't want to seem to be those people. Don't believe the polls. He's going to win. The bad angels are going for this one.
You got to watch it there, Linda, because yesterday in the supermarket, because I, too, had predicted he was going to win, and a guy came up to me in the parking lot, a good friend, who said, you know, basically, damn you, Zhartok, you made this happen by, you know, basically
well,
predicting.
You're right. Let's start right now. Blue wave.
Yeah.
Big blue wave.
The only poll that matters is the one
that
happens on Election Day.
Absolutely. That's true.
So what do you think?
That's such a politician.
Yeah. That's reality, you know?
So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I don't know, Alan. I really don't know. I think everything is so very close that I just don't know. I think Linda is right to some degree. We people are not being completely honest in answering these polls. People are saying what they think people want to hear, and I don't think we can use them as a way to gauge what's going to happen. So,
But as a politician, can you sense energy?
I can sense energy, definitely, but. I haven't sensed, to be quite honest with you, I'm not sensing the energy out in that sort of independent middle world where those people who can go either way will make the difference in this election.
Well, you know, NPR has been doing a lousy job in the mornings. Oh, did I say that? interviewing these people who might make a difference. And the last two, as I have heard them, basically made the case that these people were satisfied with Trump for one reason or another. Oh, I don't like him, but I'm going to vote for him during that time. And so it's very interesting to me that when we talk about the importance of a press and a free press, that it also, I worry sometime that some of these actors, like NPR, are bending over backwards to prove their innocence and their non-complicity in getting the right thing done.
Well, as you know, every journalist in here knows that if you're going to interview people on the street and make conclusions from it, it all depends on which people you choose to interview.
That's right.
Yeah,
and what questions you ask.
Yeah, you can't just go to one place if you really want to get a range. And
or
you
one
have to
person.
Put that in that context, too. You're responsible to that.
Yep, that's a good point.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more topics to discuss, and we'll certainly do that and get into all of it. We'll have letters as well. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. It's Halloween. It's Wednesday. Lynn Dellerby's here, Jen Smith, Terry Gibson, and Alan Chartok. We will be back right after this.
Werewolf, bar mitzvah, spooky, scary. Boys becoming men, men becoming wolves.
All right, that was great, Trey. Okay, it's over. That's a wrap. Oh, the next day.
Good morning, and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It's 6 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok is here, Jen Smith, Terry Gibson, and our special guest, Linda Ellerby, on the program this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. So we talked about this yesterday, and I want to talk a little bit about it today, which is because we know more than we did yesterday. President Trump vowing executive order to end birthright citizenship, a move that most legal experts say would run afoul of the Constitution. President Trump is vowing to sign the executive order that would seek the end to the right to end the right to U.S. citizenship for children in the United States to non-citizens, a move that most legal experts say would run afoul of the Constitution, and that was dismissed Tuesday by the House's top Republican. This is really the forward to the story. House Speaker Paul Ryan dismissed the idea during a radio interview, saying it's not consistent with the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. He said, quote, "Well, you obviously cannot do that. You cannot end birthright citizenship with an executive order." Ryan also said that Republicans did not like it when President Barack Obama changed immigration policy by executive action, and that altering the Constitution would be a lengthy process,
to say the least.
Alan.
Well, I said it earlier today, and I mean it. You can't, obviously, it's a joke. You can't alter the Constitution by signing an executive order. Otherwise, maybe a former president or two would have gotten rid of the Electoral College by just, signing it off. However, there are those people who discount the man who became president of the United States, Donald Trump, who I consider to be as reprehensible as anybody who has ever served in that office, as not being bright. He's bright, all right, in an evil, devilish way. And when he says, if you come to this country, and you shouldn't have a baby who then automatically becomes a citizen, there are an awful lot of people in his group who are going to say, right on, Don, that's exactly how I feel about it. That's wrong. So his point has been made to all of those people, even if he seems like an idiot to all of us who have ever taken a political science class about the United States Constitution.
I think the danger, too, is if, is there anything, because he will try anything possible to, if he can't completely overturn it, what can he do to chip away at the infrastructure of what that allows? And I think that's something you got to watch.
If you are right about that, then we have to go back to 1938, 1937 and see what Hitler did.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have the power to do what he was doing. He just did it. Mm-hmm. And he got away with it.
Well, Linda, that's what's happened so far.
Yeah.
Is no one's stopping him from anything so far. As you know, I'm in agreement with you. This is a campaign ploy,
sure,
and nothing more. This is. Let's not talk about the pipe bombs that got sent. Let's not talk about Pittsburgh. Let's talk about immigration, because that works for me. That just works for me. I got to bring up something here. Some of you know that I live in the coldest months of the year in Mexico. Mm-hmm. I have for years. I like Mexico. I like Mexicans. One of the stories that is so unreported in this country is, you do see it reported that immigration from Mexico to the United States has been declining every year since 2007. At the same time, immigration from the United States, Mexico, has been going up every year. And right now, more Americans are moving to Mexico. Americans are moving to Mexico at a more rapid rate than Mexicans are moving to the United States. Mm-hmm. And most of them, when they go down there, at 80% or more, are living illegally, Americans in Mexico.
Really?
They are not getting their residency visas. They go on a tourist visa and they stay. Mm-hmm. They start working. And Mexico, being a very accommodating government, allows them to do this. But it's just a little other side of the immigration we don't like to talk about is the biggest expat. Here's the thing. Explain to me this. When I live in Mexico, I'm an expat. If they come here, they're an immigrant. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Hate.
It seems to me that the people that should be banging this drum is the Mexicans.
Mm-hmm. Well, but they have their own issues. For example, it's so interesting now that they are talking about granting some kind of status to the people who are moving up here, you know, from the south. And they have their reasons for doing that. But also, they also know that Donald Trump is capable of anything with them, and they're scared of him. So you can just see the way that's moving. You know, Linda, in our little town of Great Barrington, we have a wonderful little restaurant, Bézéon, you know, in which every expat in the neighborhood comes and drinks their coffee. It's one place that expats gather. And it's so interesting that they describe themselves that way as expats very proudly. I don't know whether that fits into your discussion or not, but that's the nomenclature.
Yeah, that is.
This citizenship issue with the 14th Amendment goes all the way back to Donald Trump trying to disqualify President Obama from being an American, saying that he wasn't born here. And it goes deep, deep back into our history, all the way back to the time of slavery, which is exactly where the 14th Amendment came from, where it was actually dealing with the rights of slaves to become citizens.
Actually, the 14th Amendment came from the Dred Scott decision, which was after the slaves had been freed. And the Dred Scott decision said very simply, okay, you're free, you're not a slave, but you're not a citizen.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
it differentiated between, it's okay, you're not a slave, but you're not a citizen.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And when everybody talks to us about meet in the middle. Let's meet halfway. Well, what's your compromise? You can be be free, but you can't be a citizen. Is that the compromise?
Or there's some truth in Charlottesville on both sides. You know, what's that compromise about?
Yeah, yeah, there are good people on both sides. Where's your compromise there?
Alan is right when he says that when the president of the United States stands up and says that I'm going to go after those individuals who are having children here and making them citizens, that's not right. It's not about whether that's achievable. It's not about whether that sounds reasonable. It's about that his audience wants to hear that, and he knows it.
It's another
form
of attack. Yeah. It's absolutely another form of attack. It's damaging to people. It's who are already downtrodden. You know, I'm a naturalized citizen. I'm adopted. I came from another country. I was born in India. And by saying that, you know, it's like, can you strip your citizenship away? You know, and you know, that's just, it's another tact of putting us versus them, the sense of otherness, but in a negative way. It's the difference between, as you said, Linda, expat and immigrant.
Yeah, it's the women. It's not just immigration. The putting down in order to win and to appeal to the worst in us. It took me a year and a half to figure out the Access Hollywood tape, that he didn't win in spite of it, that he won because of it. Yeah. That there were enough people that was so pleasing to them that it actually helped him.
Okay, but you're an expert and you've
not really on anything.
I'm
a journalist.
You're a wise person. What is it about the women in this country, particularly white women, who have voted overwhelmingly for Trump?
You know, I've thought about that a lot. And I've had friends say, well, it's just they vote how their husband votes. It's not that simple. It's really not. I think a great deal of it, particularly in my generation. Now, I'm 74, so truth in advertising here. In my generation, I think it is very often that he validates their choices. They chose an old-fashioned way. And the truth is, to choose independence, you know what? It's hard. You have to be able to handle confrontation. You have to be able to support a family. You have to be able to be a grown-up in the world and know how to get things done. And nobody's going to do that for you. It ain't easy to be independent and be a woman.
So you're saying they've chosen...
He validates their choices. because they chose to be stay-at-home mothers, which is work. It's the hardest work you'll ever do as the mother of two, I will assure you that. But they chose, he validated how they would behave with men, around men, and in the larger sense of society.
Well, I think in society, too, we haven't supported, free thinking, informed decision making for people, because we've withheld information from people for so long. I think, with the case of women, I mean, we've only had the right to vote for how long? Not very long. And so I think there is, like you said, there's we have a long ways to go in terms of supporting women, not only just to vote, but to be candidates. There's no mentors out there. Obviously, you look at the numbers, there's not enough money out there. There's not a lot of belief out there. I still think there's, I was just talking about the otherness. I still think there's this belief that, women aren't as capable, even though we know that's not true.
Yeah.
But heck no, that's not true. But there's still that foundation of belief, and it's easy to join someone who looks like a powerful person who, will carry them through, who supports, the values that they did. And
Christian,
I think,
family, traditional values.
Mm-hmm, you can't say that all women think alike or experience alike. Our experiences in life are probably really different. They were, not probably. They are.
They are different. they are different, and will continue to be different. And we also live with the myth, the long-term myth, that women are natural enemies to one another.
Mm.
That if there's a public brouhaha of any kind, it's two women. It's not an argument. It's a cat fight.
Mm-hmm.
Look, she's showing her claws. She's feline. She's just, even our language tells us that we as women shouldn't be helping other women, that they are our competition.
Well, and even the statistic, Alan, you described it as, white women voters. And you have to remember, too, that, Black women voters, brown women voters, yellow women voters were never invited to the table as much as white women. They weren't given a voice. They weren't empowered to think and to act. And so there's still a long way to go on that. Again, how many people, because of the rhetoric and the tension of this country, aren't going to even be counted on a census, let alone, be counted by polls.
I just want to say that I think that we will begin to heal much of what you're talking about. We'll start when we finally get around to electing a woman president. And
that's,
I think,
going
it's
to
high
be
time
a while.
That we do that. And until we do that, I think these divisions are going to be difficult to resolve.
I no longer have any hope that I'll see that in my lifetime.
I'm sorry to hear that. And I hope that's not true, but we desperately need it. We've had a male spokesperson for this country for the entire history of the country. And we need a woman's point of view at that podium representing this country. And I do think it will be the beginning of changing some of the things you're discussing.
What's good letters in our wrapping up? And you have those two, Alan. And we'll get
just a couple of letters. Just a couple of letters. I'll read them quickly. Thank you, says Bill to Linda for telling it exactly like it is. Her wisdom needs to be shared with more people. Bill from Huntington, Massachusetts. And Bill from New Paltz. Congressman Steve Stivers of Ohio, chairman of the National Republican Conference, rebuked Congressman Steve King of Iowa for espousing white supremacy and racism in all forms. But the NRC is running racist advertising directed towards Antonio Delgado in the 19th CD race. It's true, by the way, so that's just a very interesting letter from Bill. And Joan says, thank you, Alan, for bringing up NPR. I feel the same way and found it truly disturbing. I was talking about what they were doing on their man in the street interviews this morning. And Kevin says, what the Democrats? It's not surprising that Democrats could get the government to do things for the people and not to do things to the people. And R. Jeremy says, a good story. We should have learned that neither facts nor self-interest are as important as a good story. Trump has a story. We are being taken advantage of. We are victims. We are threatened. We don't have a story. And until we get one that connects to the American people, we'll have to depend on the Republicans to screw up. And Bob says, despite the Supreme Court's ignoring the clear language and history of the Second Amendment, the amendment was intended to protect the right of citizen militias to have guns. It was not addressed to individual gun use. And Matt says, I'm not sure if it has been coined yet to help define a connection between leaders and their followers, but allow me to submit trickle-down politics. And Sarah says, alternative facts versus propaganda. Excellent points about the obfuscation of calling lying misstatement. Same thing with alternative facts versus propaganda. Isn't propaganda the correct term for alternative facts? This is not a rhetorical question. I'd really like to know what you think. Well, we're running out of time, and I have a question I have to ask Linda about Donald Trump.
I know what you're going to ask.
And Jim says, regarding Trump's lack of proof for his wild assertions, I remember mathematics proofs where after pages, I remember this too, pages of qualifications, calculations, the answer was trivial and obvious, and we could say QED. They don't do that anymore.
No, they don't
do that anymore. But QED, I've asked about people look at me and say, what? Trump starts his proof with QED. What is it? Proven as presented or something like that?
Yes. Obvious.
We'll get, yes. And Linda's, and Carol says, I'm so glad Ms. Ellerbe is part of today's panel. I hope this is the first of many such occasions. Overnight with Linda Ellerbe was Special Enlightening News Program. I watched it religiously. I was so disappointed it was canceled. I love the irrelevant no BS attitude, no BS attitude Ms. Ellerbe offered for a country and so in need of it today. And so it goes. So thanks.
Right.
And Linda, I guess I got to ask you the obvious question. Have you ever met Donald Trump?
So it was 1972, and I was the, quote, hard news reporter for the 11 o'clock news on Channel 2 in New York City, which meant I covered strikes, fires, murders, and then was on the 11 o'clock news live. And either that first year or the second year that I was there, Donald Trump began to call me and ask me out. We'd never met.
Whoa, whoa.
But even after a year and a half in the job, I'd read enough about Donald that I did not see any reason to want to meet him or go out with him. So I said, no. Okay. Cut to 10 or so years later, a dinner party at the John Bradenton, who had been the House Majority Leader when I had covered the Congress for NBC News, was now the president of NYU. And he had a dinner party.
Bradamus, right?
Yes, John Bradamus, exactly. Bradamus, yeah. That's, I was going to say the name, and I thought nobody will know who that is, but you do.
Yeah, because I went to NYU.
Yes. The NYU president has a lovely apartment. Surprise, surprise. So I get there for cocktail hour, and I'm sitting on an ottoman in the living room, and somebody comes behind me and puts their hands around and over my eyes and says, guess who? Now, I don't like that on my best day. And since dinner parties are never my best days, I said, I'm not going to play this. You know, take your hands off me. And I don't really care who you are. Well, that didn't work. So he took his hands off me. And I looked around, and it was Donald Trump.
Oh,
hi. Nice to meet you. Now, gross. I had wandered into the dining room. There were about 16 people for dinner. Earlier in the evening, just because I'm not comfortable at parties and I wander around because I'm not good at talking to strangers unless I have a notebook in front of me. And I had seen the place cards and I had seen who was sitting by me. I knew both of them. That was interesting. When we're called in to dinner, I go in and the place cards have been moved and Donald Trump is sitting next to me. So I thought, okay, fine, I'll be polite. I'll talk to the person on my left. I'll talk to the person on my right. I'll do the things I was raised to do. I can handle this. I got along fine until the point. I think he may have been married to Ivana at this point, but he looked at me and he said to the table, you know, Linda, you were so wrong not to go out with me. And I said, really? Why? And he said, if you'd played your cards right, you could have been Mrs. The Donald.
Wow.
Oh. That's disgusting.
Wow. Oh. That little detail
vomit
tells you.
Mrs. The Donald.
The Donald. That he referred to himself that way is a telling detail about
Great story.
That man.
Well, that right. doesn't make your skin crawl.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I mean, that is a good Halloween.
And you know, I go to bed every night regretting my choice.
What could have been?
Right. Well, you know, the first lady. No, you would have been long gone by then, wouldn't you? All right. The good news is that Linda's going to stay over. We're going to talk to her about her amazing career.
All right.
For a while, and I'm going to keep her after school here for a second. Thank you so much for coming in for the panel. Delight to have you. Thanks to just so you know, I put out a note to all of my colleagues, and I said Linda Ellerbe is coming on, and I would love for people who are just true amazing fans, and the first two people who responded like begging to come on. Jen and Terry, so I'm thrilled they're both here.
Well, the delight is mine, and I'll come back any Wednesday. You know,
yes.
So
excellent. That's wonderful. Alan, thank you very much. I know you've got a busy morning, and we're going to shuffle you off to another studio. You got a big interview here too
with John Fesso.
There you go. And so it goes. We'll be right back after this.